And that's a good thing. And we're going to talk about that. How do you get access to the bonus show? You go to joinpacman.com and sign up. That's it. And then lastly, Tuesday, October 19, we are doing an exclusive viewer town hall where I will just open the phones and take questions from everybody. 6 p.m. Eastern, Tuesday, October 19th. It will be streamed exclusively on our second YouTube channel, Pacman Live. Find it at youtube.com/PacmanLive or davidpacman.com/PacmanLive. Whatever's easier to type. Either way, October 19th, Tuesday, 6 East, 3 West. Members get priority, but we will be opening up the Discord lines to everybody. All right, we'll talk to you on the bonus show.
Are we still taping?
Yeah, sure. Go right ahead.
We're live. We're not taping.
Oh, we're live.
No,
okay.
We're taping.
We're taping. Okay. They want me to do a little promo. And what do? I say WRCT. Is that it?
WRCT Pittsburgh. Yeah.
Okay. Right. Hello and speedy delivery. This is Mr. McFeely from Mr. Rogers' Neighborhood. And I'm in Pittsburgh. I always listen to WRCT right here in Pittsburgh. Speedy delivery to you.
WRCT Pittsburgh. We're always here for you.
We own and your soul is next.
We don't actually have the legal documentation to back that up.
You're listening to WRCT Feedback Radio.
Hi, this is Felicia Collins from Late Show with David Letterman, and you are listening to WRCT Pittsburgh.
Arr, I'm from Creationist Crucifixion.
Arr, I'm not attractive and I'm from Steel Curtain.
Me neither, arr.
WRCT.
Pittsburgh, 88.3, arr.
This is Danny Glover, and you're listening to 88.3 FM WRCT Pittsburgh.
Hey, this is Tom from the band Loose, and you are listening to 88.3 WRCT Pittsburgh.
From New York, Rock Raider.
Yeah, yeah, 1-2, Total Eclipse.
From Executioners, and we chilling on WRCT.
Word up, Pittsburgh representing 88.3 FM.
Check it out,
dial. All right? Peace.
Soon, pay toilets will take over the world, and everyone, everywhere, will listen to WRCT Pittsburgh, 88.3 FM.
WRCT is the best place to be. He sends the music out your way, 40 hours every day.
Yeah, yeah, what's up? This is Total Eclipse.
Word up, Rock Raider from Executioners.
Word up, chilling,
On WRCT, Pittsburgh.
Yeah, yeah, right, 88.3.
Check it out, all right?
Word up, real hip hop.
Yeah, thanks, man.
You don't even know it's the hip hop show.
We do everything.
Depose from the faint. Do you think I'm hot? You're listening to WRCT Pittsburgh.
WRCT Pittsburgh, we won't respect you in the morning.
Hey, we're the 1985, and whenever we're in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania, we like to pick up 13-year-old runaways at the Greyhound station and listen to WRCT! Woo!
RCT Pittsburgh, music for your inner robot.
WRCT Radio 900.
Hey, this is Jim from Rusted Root, and you're listening to WRCT 88.3 in Pittsburgh. Yow.
WRCT, Pittsburgh.
Yeah, that's where things like this go, right down the drain.
Hey there, folks. Glad you could join me. For all the best, the smoothest of the smooth, the cool and gentle sounds of what we call jazz.
Tired of the fluffy stuff? At WRCT Pittsburgh, jazz is a one-song word.
WRCT Pittsburgh. The last bastion of pulchritude.
Yeah,
Well, this is Kimani Mali, and you're listening to WRCT-FM. Keep it locked, Rasta.
This is Satan. You're listening to WRCT Pittsburgh, 88.3 FM.
From New York, this is Democracy Now!
Facebook has demonstrated they cannot act independently. Facebook over and over again has shown it chooses profit over safety. It is subsidizing, it is paying for its profits with our safety. I'm hoping that this will have had a big enough impact on the world that they get the fortitude and the motivation to actually go put those regulations into place.
After blowing the whistle on how Facebook's own research indicates it prioritizes profits over the welfare of its users, former Facebook product manager Frances Haugen is set to testify to Congress today about how the social media giant boosts disinformation and hate speech and contributes to eating disorders and suicidal thoughts among teenage girls. We'll speak with Roger McNamee, an early Facebook investor, a Zuckerberg mentor, who wrote the book Zucked, Waking Up to the Facebook Catastrophe. And Jessica Gonzalez, co-CEO of Free Press, member of the Real Facebook Oversight Board, who co-founded Change the Terms, a coalition that works to disrupt online hate, then the Pandora Papers.
This leak is really Panama Papers on steroids. This is the Pandora Papers, because we think we're opening a box on a lot of things. We're looking at about 12 million documents from 14 different service providers. These are law firms and firms that set up secret offshore accounts for people in multiple jurisdictions. The British Virgin Islands, Belize, Samoa. These documents, for the very first time, is actually showing the U.S. as a tax haven itself.
We look at the new report with an editor from the International Consortium of Investigative Journalists and at the connection between offshore banking and colonialism. All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. Facebook whistleblower Frances Haugen's testifying on Capitol Hill today, expected to call on lawmakers to take action against Facebook for the harm it poses to its users and the world. According to her prepared remarks, she'll say, quote, "When we realized tobacco companies were hiding the harms it caused, the government took action. When we figured out cars were safer with seatbelts, the government took action. And today, the government is taking action against companies that hid evidence on opioids. I implore you to do the same here." Haugen's testimony comes a day after Facebook, WhatsApp, and Instagram suffered a six-hour outage disrupting online communication across the globe. We'll have more on Facebook after headlines. Johnson & Johnson has asked the Food and Drug Administration to authorize booster shots for its coronavirus vaccine. An FDA advisory panel will review the request at a meeting next week when it might also consider a booster shot from Moderna. Meanwhile, AstraZeneca has requested emergency use authorization from the FDA for its coronavirus antibody therapy, which the company claims reduces the chances of developing COVID by 77%. In other pandemic news, the largest healthcare network in New York State, Northwell, has fired about 1,400 workers who refused to get vaccinated. That's less than 2% of its staff. The state is mandating vaccines for all hospital and nursing home workers. While COVID cases continue to fall in much of the country, many areas remain in crisis. In California, the National Guard's been deployed to help overwhelmed hospitals in rural areas. In Alaska, doctors have been forced to ration care, essentially deciding which patients will live and who will die. President Biden's accused Senate Republicans of playing Russian roulette with the U.S. economy for blocking efforts to raise the U.S. government's debt limit. Biden warned the Republican move could be catastrophic for the economy.
Meteor is headed to crash into our economy. Democrats are willing to do all the work stopping it. Republicans just have to let us do our job. Just get out of the way. If you don't want to help save the country, get out of the way so you don't destroy it.
Meanwhile, grassroots pressure is growing on Democratic Senators Joe Manchin and Kyrsten Sinema to back a $3.5 trillion reconciliation package to expand the nation's social safety net and combat the climate emergency. On Sunday, a group of activists followed Sinema into a bathroom at Arizona State University, where she teaches, urging Sinema to back Biden's economic agenda. Video of the incident was posted online by the group Living United for Change in Arizona.
Right now is a real moment that our people need in order for us to be able to talk about what's really happening. We need a Build Back Better plan right now.
We knocked on a door. We need solutions. The Build Back Better plan has the solutions that we need.
We knocked on doors for you to get you elected. And just how we got you elected, we can get you out of office if you don't support what you promised us.
A senior lawyer at the State Department has blasted the Biden administration for continuing to mass expel asylum seekers without due process under the Trump-era policy, Title 42. The attorney, Harold Koh, described the expulsions as illegal and inhumane. In a memo, Koh wrote, quote, "I believe this administration's current implementation of the Title 42 authority continues to violate our legal obligation not to expel or return individuals who fear persecution, death, or torture, especially migrants fleeing from Haiti," he said. Harold Koh is leaving the Biden administration soon to teach at Oxford. California Governor Gavin Newsom has declared a state of emergency in Orange County following what's been described as California's worst oil spill in nearly three decades. Officials now say as many as 144,000 gallons of oil has leaked from a pipeline connected to an offshore oil platform off the coast of Huntington Beach, about 30 miles south of Los Angeles. Investigators are looking into whether a ship anchor punctured the pipeline. Beaches in the area are expected to be closed for months. This is Orange County District Attorney Todd Spitzer.
Orange County District Attorney's Office is deeply concerned about the wildlife impact that has occurred on our shores and the economic impact to our community. And somebody's going to pay for that, criminally or civilly.
Environmental groups are calling on authorities to ban offshore oil drilling. Monica Embry of the Sierra Club's Beyond Dirty Fuels campaign said, quote, "How many of these oil disasters do we have to witness before our elected leaders understand there is no safe way to drill or transport dirty fossil fuels?" she asked. In related news, the Biden administration is moving ahead with a plan to open up 80 million acres of the Gulf of Mexico to new oil and gas drilling. An auction for drilling rights is scheduled for mid-November, but a coalition of environmental groups has sued to block the sale from moving forward. In climate news, a major new UN-backed study has found the world lost about 14% of its coral reefs between 2009 and 2018 due to rising temperatures. Researchers say coral reefs face an existential crisis. The Biden administration's reversed a Trump-era ban that blocked federally funded family planning clinics from referring patients for abortions or even mentioning abortion as an option. The so-called domestic gag rule had threatened health care for millions who rely on Title X health centers for primary and preventive care. Planned Parenthood Federation of America President Alexis McGill Johnson said the lifting of the Trump rule was, quote, "a huge victory for patients and a huge victory for sexual and reproductive health care." To see our full interview with Alexis McGill Johnson, go to democracynow.org. A federal judge has sentenced a participant in the January 6th insurrection to 45 days in jail, a far harsher sentence than requested by federal prosecutors who asked for 3 months of home confinement. Matthew Mazzocco flew from Texas to join others in Washington who were trying to overturn the 2020 election. Judge Tanya Chutkan said, quote, "If Mr. Mazzocco walks away with probation and a slap on the wrist, that's not going to deter anyone from trying to do what he did." Tens of thousands of Hollywood crew workers have voted to authorize a strike over disputes with studio producers on the work conditions and pay for crew working on streaming productions for Netflix, Apple, Amazon, and others. The workers are represented by YATSE, the International Alliance of Theatrical Stage Employees. This is Rebecca Ryan, the union's executive director.
We have some members in our crafts that are so underpaid that they can't possibly survive in the cities where they provide services. And so we're looking for a livable wage for them. And we're looking for the employers to keep their long ago made promise that when new media moved from experimental to successful, that our members would then be paid industry standard rates for doing that work. And I don't think there's anyone that thinks Apple and Amazon and Disney need a break in order to produce their product.
A major investigation in France is estimating 330,000 children were sexually abused by Catholic clergy or lay members of the church since 1950. The head of the inquiry said the church had, quote, showed a profound and even cruel indifference towards the victims. Jean-Marc Sauvé, who headed the independent commission, spoke earlier today.
Un point majeur.
A major point that must be underlined is that until the early 2000s, there was deep, total, and even cruel indifference for the years towards the victims. The victims were not believed, were not listened to. When they were listened to, they were considered to have perhaps contributed to what had happened to them.
The Israeli newspaper Haaretz is reporting there's been a surge in Jewish settler violence against Palestinians in the occupied West Bank over the past 2 years. There were more cases of anti-Palestinian violence in the first half of 2021 than in all of 2019. Last week, the human rights group B'Tselem released a video of dozens of mass settlers escorted by Israeli security forces attacking Palestinian residents. B'Tselem said the settlers invaded Palestinian homes, smashed windows, and damaged equipment and vehicles. A 3-year-old Palestinian boy was later hospitalized with a fractured skull. B'Tselem described the attack as a pogrom. Bangladesh is continuing to investigate last week's murder of one of the most prominent figures in the Rohingya refugee community. Mohibullah was gunned down in a refugee camp in Cox's Bazar. He had spent years gathering evidence against the Burmese military's ethnic cleansing campaign targeting Rohingya Muslims. 6 men have been arrested in his murder so far. Philippines President Rodrigo Duterte has announced he's retiring from politics after his term ends next year. He had previously said he would run for the vice presidency. Duterte is currently under investigation by the International Criminal Court for overseeing the mass killing of up to 30,000 people in his so-called war against drugs. On Monday, Duterte said he'll be involved in preparing for his defense in the ICC probe. Meanwhile, Ferdinand Marcos Jr., the son of the former Filipino dictator, has announced he'll run in next year's elections. There's also speculation Duterte's daughter may run as well. The United Nations is saying over 5,100 refugees have now been detained in western Libya as part of a sweeping crackdown. The detained include over 200 children. This comes as UN investigators accuse multiple sides in the Libyan conflict of committing possible war crimes, including torture, enslavement, and extrajudicial killings. Many of the crimes targeted refugees who are trying to flee to Europe. In sports news, U.S. Soccer has hired former acting Attorney General Sally Yates to investigate abusive behavior and sexual misconduct in the National Women's Soccer League. Last week, North Carolina Courage coach Paul Riley was fired after he was accused of coercing a player into having sex with him. The coach of the Washington Spirit was also fired last week over allegations of verbal and emotional abuse. On Friday, the commissioner of the National Women's Soccer League resigned and the league canceled all of its weekend games. Some of the nation's largest pharmacy chains, including CVS, Walgreens, and Walmart, are on trial in Cleveland, Ohio, for recklessly selling painkillers fueling the deadly opioid epidemic. The pharmacies were sued in 2018 by two counties in Ohio. If convicted, the pharmacies could be on the hook to pay billions of dollars to help end the epidemic. The trial began on Monday. And Congress members Cori Bush and Emanuel Cleaver are calling on Missouri's Republican governor to halt today's scheduled execution of Ernest Lee Johnson, an intellectually disabled black man. In 2008, Johnson lost about 20% of his brain during a surgery to remove a tumor. In their letter, Bush and Cleaver write, quote, "Like slavery and lynching did before it, the death penalty perpetuates cycles of trauma, violence, and state-sanctioned murder in black and brown communities." And those are some of the headlines. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. When we come back, Facebook whistleblower Frances Haugen is testifying on Capitol Hill today. She's expected to call on lawmakers to take action against Facebook for the harm it poses to its users and the world. We'll speak with Roger McNamee, an early Facebook investor and Zuckerberg mentor, who wrote the book Zucked, Waking Up to the Facebook Catastrophe. And we'll speak with Jessica Gonzalez, co-CEO of Free Press and member of the Real Facebook Oversight Board. She works with a coalition that works to disrupt online hate. Stay with us. Now by Men at Work. And this is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman in New York with Democracy Now! Co-host Juan Gonzalez in New Brunswick, New Jersey. Hi, Juan.
Hi, Amy, and welcome to all of our listeners and viewers across the country and around the world.
Well, we begin today's show looking at a massive leak of tens of thousands of internal Facebook documents that show the social media's own research indicates its algorithm helps boost disinformation, hate speech, and political unrest around the world, and that Facebook executives knew about it but kept the damning information hidden from the public. The leak also implicates Facebook in issues of child safety and human trafficking, while it prioritized profits over people's welfare. The documents were behind a sweeping investigation by the Wall Street Journal and were unveiled by whistleblower and former Facebook product manager Frances Haugen. She secretly copied the pages before leaving her job at the company's Civic Integrity Unit in May. Haugen spoke publicly for the first time Sunday on CBS's 60 Minutes with reporter Scott Pelley.
To quote from another one of the documents you brought out, "We have evidence from a variety of sources that hate speech, divisive political speech, and misinformation on Facebook and the family of apps are affecting societies around the world."
When we live in an information environment that is full of angry, hateful, polarizing content, it erodes our civic trust, it erodes our faith in each other, it erodes our ability to want to care for each other. The version of Facebook that exists today is tearing our societies apart and causing ethnic violence around the world.
Haugen has filed a federal complaint against Facebook and is testifying today before the Senate Commerce Subcommittee on Consumer Protection. According to her prepared remarks, she'll call on lawmakers to take action against Facebook for the harm it poses to its users and the world. She's expected to say, quote, "When we realized tobacco companies were hiding the harms it caused, the government took action. When we figured out cars were safer with seatbelts, the government took action. And today the government's taking action against companies that hid evidence on opioids. I implore you to do the same here," she said. Today's panel is also looking into how Facebook downplayed its knowledge that its photo and video sharing app Instagram is harmful for teen girls and tweens. This is Haugen again speaking on CBS's 60 Minutes to reporter Scott Pelley.
One study says 13.5% of teen girls say Instagram makes thoughts of suicide worse. 17% of teen girls say Instagram makes eating disorders worse.
And what's super tragic is Facebook's own research says as these young women begin to consume this eating disorder content, they get more and more depressed, and it actually makes them use the app more. And so they end up in this feedback cycle where they hate their bodies more and more. Facebook's own research says it is not just that Instagram is dangerous for teenagers, that it harms teenagers. It's that it is distinctly worse than other forms of social media.
Lawmakers are also pursuing Facebook as part of a federal antitrust case and over its role in the January 6th Capitol insurrection. Documents leaked by Frances Haugen detail Facebook's decision to dissolve its civic integrity unit after the 2020 election and before the assault on the Capitol. Her testimony comes a day after Facebook, Instagram, and WhatsApp, also owned by Facebook, suffered a six-hour outage disrupting online communication worldwide. It's the first time this has happened for so long. For more, we're joined in San Francisco by Roger McNamee. He was an early investor in Facebook. He was a Mark Zuckerberg mentor, then went on to write the book Zucked, Waking Up to the Facebook Catastrophe. And in Los Angeles, we're joined by Jessica Gonzalez. She is co-CEO of the media advocacy group Free Press and co-founder of Change the Terms, a coalition that works to disrupt online hate. She's also a member of the Real Facebook Oversight Board. We welcome you both to Democracy Now! Jessica, let's begin with you. As you listen to this testimony of Frances Haugen and all of these documents that have been released, I mean, it was really amazing to see these congressional hearings in the last few weeks where you have Facebook being confronted by senators. And the senators are saying these studies that you did not reveal, like the damage you do to tweens and teen girls, are astounding. And she said, oh, actually, they're really bad studies. They said, no, they're really good studies. But overall, your response to what's taking place right now?
Listen, Amy, good morning. I'm not surprised that Facebook knew that it was causing concrete harm to women, to people of color, to society as a whole. I'm not surprised it knew that it was spreading disinformation about the vaccine, the pandemic, and other things. What I'm surprised about is just how blatantly they lied to the American public, including members of Congress, over and over again about the extent to which they were causing harm here in the United States and around the world. That's the shocking part here, is just the number of bald-faced lies repeated over and over again. It indicates clearly that Facebook is unfit to self-govern and that we need the U.S. Congress and the administration to step in and provide transparency and accountability.
And Jessica, I wanted to ask you, in terms of Facebook's record and its ability to monitor hate speech, you've also raised questions about the fact that it's not just in the English language, given the enormous international reach of Facebook, in other languages as well. Have you been noticing a difference between how it even monitors English language material versus those in other languages across the country, given, for instance, the enormous impact that right-wing groups from Latin America had through WhatsApp and other Facebook posts during the election to reach Spanish-speaking people here in the U.S.?
Yes, Juan, as bad as this situation is in English, it's far worse in Spanish and other non-English languages. That's why we work together with partners from the Center for American Progress and National Hispanic Media Coalition to launch the Ya Basta Facebook campaign, Enough Already Facebook. We were calling for concrete steps, investment in content moderation and AI systems, in the personnel needed to accurately and adequately monitor non-English content on Facebook. And we really got a complete blow off from Facebook. In fact, Facebook wouldn't even tell us who's in charge of Spanish language content moderation, how many moderators do they have, where are those people located, what are the systems and trainings in place. They won't even provide baseline transparency. Well, come to find out, part of what Frances Haugen helped reveal this week is that Facebook is not adequately invested in any language besides perhaps English and French. They've made some investments in those areas, but they've utterly failed to make the investments necessary to make Facebook safe in other languages. And I have to tell you, Juan, you know, if it were me and I was running Facebook and I hear from the United Nations that I played a contributing role in the genocide in Myanmar, I would have looked right away at this issue, at whether our moderation systems were keeping people safe, particularly around the globe. And so the fact that that didn't happen is appalling and unacceptable.
I'd like to bring in Roger McNamee to the conversation. Welcome to Democracy Now! And could you talk to us about your reaction to the latest revelations from Frances Haugen and how you initially began to believe that Facebook was on a negative and dangerous course?
Well, it's a great honor to be back on the show with you all today. And I want to tip my hat to my friend Jessica, because I think she framed many of the problems exactly correctly. I also want to throw out a huge, you know, thanks to Frances Haugen. She is so courageous, so authoritative, and so utterly convincing. I mean, this is a person who is in a position of enormous responsibility at Facebook, who is very technically competent, who saw these problems and had the courage to bring documents out to make sure the whole world knows. That level of courage is just, I mean, we should be all applauding it. You know, my own experience, I was an advisor to Mark in the early days of Facebook. I mean, he was 22 when we met, and I advised him when the company, starting before it even had a news feed. My concerns became an issue for me in early 2016, and I reached out to Mark Zuckerberg and Sheryl Sandberg just before the election in 2016 to warn them, because I was afraid. I'd seen these things going on that really bothered me, and it made me fear that the culture of Facebook, the business model and the algorithms were allowing bad people to harm innocent people in the context of civil rights, which is what Jess was just talking about, but also democracy. And, you know, I pleaded with them because I said, you know, you're in a business that depends on trust. You have to get this right. And I spent months trying to convince Facebook to do the right thing, starting before the election 2016 and then continuing for several months after. That didn't work, so I became an activist. The key thing about Frances Haugen, and the reason that she has changed the game more in 3 weeks than I could in 5 years, is because she brought out documents that established definitively that the executives at Facebook were aware of the problems, and that in spite of warnings on things like COVID disinformation, on things like the insurrection, on things like the damage to teenage girls, they persisted. And they persisted because of a business model that's not just at Facebook. We can't just let this be about Facebook, because the business model of surveillance capitalism, which is a concept that was coined by the professor Shoshana Zuboff from Harvard, this is a business model of using surveillance to gather data in every possible context and using that to both predict our behavior and to manipulate our choices and our behavior. And that is so fundamentally un-American, so fundamentally unethical, that we have to ban it. It's as unethical as child labor, and it's something being adopted by companies throughout the economy. Google invented it, Facebook adopted it, Amazon uses it, Microsoft, many other tech companies have become the leaders in it. But you see it in cars now and in smart devices. You see it all over the economy, and it's incredibly dangerous.
You talked about the bravery of Frances Haugen. In fact, she is afraid, and that makes her even more brave. She's taking on a $1 trillion company, physically yes. Afraid. What kind of retaliation Facebook could wage against her? Do you have any thoughts on that, Roger?
I think her strategy of maximum public attention is exactly right. I mean, let's face it. The people who organized this communication strategy have done a brilliant job. And I really tip my hat to them. And I tip my hat to her. And I think her best defense is to be so visible that Facebook wouldn't dare. You know, their past strategy has been to use ad hominem and to essentially invent stories. You remember the famous one about George Soros after he gave a speech at the Davos conference criticizing Facebook. You know, they hired a negative research company to invent an anti-Semitic story about George Soros and spread it through the press. That has been their past behavior. I mean, listen, I don't think these people are criminals, at least not in the way they think about the world, but I do believe they have a very different value system, and that their value system, which is about efficiency and speed and growth and profit and power, is in conflict with democracy, and it's in conflict with our right to make our own choices. And the country has to make a decision. Are we going to allow corporations to essentially replace the government as the people who control our lives? Or are we going to recognize that the government is us and that it can, in fact, represent us as long as we insist that it do so? And that's what we have to do with Congress today. Francis is going in there to testify. And Congress will string this out if we let them. And what we need to do is to say to them, I'm sorry, it's time to have safety laws, it's time to have privacy laws, and it's time to have new antitrust laws.
I want to play a few clips for one sec, one, just to give people a sense of where Congress is going. In this Senate hearing, Antigone Davis, the global head of safety of Facebook, faced questions on its internal research on young children and their use of the app. She was questioned by Connecticut Senator Richard Blumenthal, chair of the Subcommittee on Consumer Protection.
I don't understand, Ms. Davis, how you can deny that Instagram isn't exploiting young users for its own profits.
As someone who was a teenage girl herself, and as someone who's taught middle school and teenage girls, I've seen firsthand the troubling intersection between the pressure to be perfect, between body image and finding your identity at that age. And I think what's been lost in this report is that, in fact, with this research, we found that more teen girls actually find Instagram helpful. Teen girls who are suffering from these issues find Instagram helpful than not. Now, that doesn't mean that the ones that aren't important to us. In fact, that's why we do this research.
Well, it's if I may interrupt you, Ms. Davis, these are your own reports. These findings are from your own studies and your own experts. You can speak from your own experience, but will you disclose all of the reports, all of the findings? Will you commit to full disclosure?
I know that we have released a number of the reports, and we are looking to find ways to release more of this research. I want to be clear that this research is not a bombshell. It's not causal research. It's, in fact, just
directional
research.
Well, I beg to differ with you, Ms. Davis. This research is a bombshell. It is powerful, gripping, riveting evidence that Facebook knows of the harmful effects of its site on children and that it has concealed those facts and findings.
Facebook recently postponed the launch of its new Instagram app for kids under 18 once Haugen released these documents. During the Senate hearing last week, Massachusetts Senator Ed Markey questioned the global head of safety of Facebook, Antigone Davis, on the platform's potential harm to children.
Will you stop launching? Will you promise not to launch a site that includes features such as like buttons and follower counts that allow children to quantify popularity? That's a yes or a no.
Those are the kinds of features that we will be talking about with our experts, trying to understand, in fact, what is most age appropriate and what isn't age appropriate. And we will discuss those features with them, of course.
Well, let me just say this. We're talking about 12-year-olds. We're talking about 9-year-olds. If you need to do more research on this, you should fire all the people who you've paid to do your research up until now, because this is pretty obvious, and it's pretty obvious to every mother and father in our country, because all recent scientific studies by child development experts found that not getting enough likes on social media significantly reduces adolescents' feelings of self-worth.
So that's it from the Senate hearing, but I want to end in these series of clips with Frances Haugen herself, the interview on 60 Minutes, when the former Facebook product manager explains how the social media's algorithm works and describes how the document she leaked lay out Facebook's decision to dissolve its civic integrity unit after the 2020 election and before the January 6th Capitol insurrection. She's speaking with CBS's Scott Pelley.
And one of the consequences of how Facebook is picking out that content today is it is optimizing for content that gets engagement or reaction. But its own research is showing that content that is hateful, that is divisive, that is polarizing, it's easier to inspire people to anger than it is to other emotions.
Misinformation, angry content is enticing to people and keeps them on the platform.
Yes. Facebook has realized that if they change the algorithm to be safer, people will spend less time on the site, they'll click on less ads, they'll make less money.
Haugen says Facebook understood the danger to the 2020 election, so it turned on safety systems to reduce misinformation.
Too dangerous.
But many of those changes, she says, were temporary.
And as soon as the election was over, they turned them back off, or they changed the settings back to what they were before, to prioritize growth over safety. And that really feels like a betrayal of democracy to me.
So that's Frances Haugen, who's testifying today on Capitol Hill on CBS's 60 Minutes. Jessica Gonzalez, you're the CEO of Free Press, and you're co-founder of the Change the Terms Coalition, which works to disrupt online hate. This key point, whether we're talking about tween and teen girls or whether we're talking about the insurrection, right before the insurrection, they knew the level of hate that was mounting and being amplified, and they turned off the monitors and the disruptors of that.
That's right. That's right, Amy. You know, and not only did they know, the fix is so easy. They have a setting. They decided to turn it off before the election results were certified, despite spotting trends of fake information about a supposed steal of the election, despite seeing the activity budding on their site, despite seeing that there were militia groups organizing calls to arms on different parts of their networks. So this was a choice to put profits over public safety, over democracy, over the health and well-being of not just Facebook users, but all of us. And this is why I don't believe that Facebook is fit to govern itself. We need to step in. And, you know, here's what's really insidious about how Facebook's business model operates, which isn't true of, like, maybe young girls receive negative messaging in magazines or on TV or on radio. But here's what's insidious in particular about how not just Facebook, but other social media platforms earn their revenues. They are collecting and extracting our personal demographic data, the way we're behaving on the sites, and they're identifying what we might be vulnerable to, right? Our vulnerabilities, our predispositions, our behaviors. And they're actually targeting us with things that they think we'll engage more with. So this is targeted disinformation, targeted hate, targeted imagery that might have caused teen girls to feel worse about themselves, based on the extraction of our data without informed consent. I don't know that most people understand that we're the product on Facebook. They're selling us to their advertisers. And so without even truly understanding how this works, we're being used and without any public interest good. In fact, a whole lot of harm. So we have to completely rethink the structures that underpin social media platforms, and we need to pass legislation. We need FTC investigations to completely disrupt the hate and lie for profit business model that is doing so much damage.
And Roger McNamee, I wanted to ask you, what is the difference between what Facebook is doing now and what the old legacy media companies had done in the past? After all, those of us who came up in the old legacy media understood that the maxim, if it bleeds, it leads, that conflict and fear and division are what sell in media. To what degree is Facebook only magnifying the trends that have always existed in commercial media in the United States? Although, of course, at different times, there were efforts to curb those media, the breakup of the Associated Press monopoly back in 1945 by the Supreme Court, there have been efforts, the breakup of the original NBC network because it had too much control over radio in America. Do you think it's time to break up Facebook?
So Juan, really important question. So Jessica talked about how this works at the individual level. Let's think about how traditional media worked. It was a broadcast model. So one message for everyone. What internet platforms have done and what surveillance capitalism does broadly, so throughout the economy, is that it targets us individually. There is a giant marketplace in the United States for data. So we call this third-party data. So companies gather data in one place and then sell it to other people in other places for other kinds of uses, and they make additional money from doing that. So everything that you do that touches something digital, so if you travel, if you do a financial transaction, use a credit card, your home loan, whatever, anything you do on your phone, including your real-time location, anything you do in an app, anything that you do online, all of this is captured. And it's all available in a marketplace. So these companies can create a digital model of you. And they do this for everybody, whether you're on internet platforms or not. They have everybody in the system. They create the digital model, and they use that model to make predictions. Now, you can sell the predictions to an advertiser, or you can use them in other ways. For example, they're used in the banking industry in order to give out mortgages. Police departments use it for predictive policing. Now, what have we learned? Those two things are based on artificial intelligence. They train artificial intelligence with historical data. The historical data is filled with biases. So you wind up moving to a world of digital redlining for mortgages so that Black people can only live in certain communities. They can't live wherever they want. They have different mortgage rates, different housing prices because of this unfair stuff from the past. And you get things like predictive policing, which over-police Brown and Black communities because, again, of historical biases that are built into these systems. So if you think about this, the manifest unfairness of it is magnified by a corporate culture that says the only people that matter are shareholders. And if you think about it, optimizing for shareholder value is like, it's the equivalent of saying, I'm just following orders. It forgives all manner of sins. And when Francis Haugen was talking about the moral crisis of CEOs who maximize profits instead of the public good, one of the challenges here is this is a country we have accepted this notion that corporations should only worry about shareholder value. That has to change. That is one of the things that Congress needs to do right now. They've done enough studies. We've done enough hearings. We now need to have something that looks like the Food and Drug Administration, which requires that every technology product demonstrate that it is safe before it is allowed to go into the market. And that should apply to products that are in the market today. We need to have rules that say, I'm sorry, but there should be no third-party marketplace for location data, health data, anything related to your usage of apps or the internet, maybe even financial data, things that are so intimate that they allow people to manipulate your choices. And then we need to have new laws on antitrust so that we can fight against entrenched corporate power.
Well, I want to thank you both so much. How well does Facebook know you? After 10 likes, better than colleagues. After 70 likes, better than friends. After 150 likes, better than family. And after 300 likes, better than your partner or spouse. Roger McNamee, author of Zucked, Waking Up to the Facebook Catastrophe, and Jessica Gonzalez, co-CEO of Free Press, member of the Real Facebook Oversight Board, and co-founder of Change the Terms, which works to disrupt online hate. Next up, we look at the revelations in the Pandora Papers about the offshore financial dealings of the world's richest and most powerful people and the connections between offshore banking and colonialism. Back in 30 seconds.
And give them to the birds and bees. I want money. That's what I want. That's what I want. That's what I want. Your love gives me such a thrill. But your love won't pay my bills. I want money.
Money by the Flying Lizards. This is Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez. As we look at what has been revealed about the murky financial dealings of the world's richest and most powerful people in a new report by the International Consortium of Investigative Journalists called the Pandora Papers.
This leak is really Panama Papers on steroids. This is the Pandora Papers, because we think we're opening a box on a lot of things. We're looking at about 12 million documents from 14 different service providers. These are law firms, firms that set up secret offshore accounts for people in multiple jurisdictions. The British Virgin Islands, Belize, Samoa. These documents, for the very first time, is actually showing the U.S. as a tax haven itself.
330 politicians from 90 countries.
We're talking about some of the most famous people in the world that are in these documents. Presidents, prime ministers, government ministers, the King of Jordan, a number of very high-profile Russian clients, people that are very close to Vladimir Putin. We're seeing them buying real estate. We're seeing them, you know, trading in shares, using offshore companies. They're buying houses, cars, artworks. I guess it mostly demonstrates that the people that could end the secrecy of offshore, could end what's going on, are themselves benefiting from it, so there's no incentive for them to end it.
The biggest journalism partnership in history, led by ICIJ.
We're not looking at a couple of million dollars here. We're looking at trillions of dollars.
The financial centers of the world, like the U.S., Europe, leaders are able to funnel and siphon money away and hide it in these jurisdictions through the use of anonymous companies.
And masking 29,000 owners of shell companies in tax havens.
These are not just like politicians and powerful people. We're talking about rock stars, including a lot of celebrities. And people that have been convicted of crimes all over the world.
A jury here in Los Angeles found 78-year-old Robert Durst guilty of first-degree murder.
Under arrest in Marbella, fugitive Rafael Amato, boss of a separatist Camorra
clan. The Rosendahl family, accused in the United States of money laundering, connected to drug trafficking.
The ability to hide money has a direct impact on your life. It affects your child's access to education, access to health, access to a home.
We're looking at a system here that is harming people. It's harming the world. And it's important that people know about it.
That's a video by the International Consortium of Investigative Journalists about the Pandora Papers, a collaboration of more than 600 reporters from 150 media outlets in 117 countries. The first reports from the project were published Sunday, and news stories are coming out every day. For more, we're joined in Washington, D.C. by Ben Hallman, senior editor at the International Consortium of Investigative Journalists, and Vanessa Ogle, professor of history at the University of California, Berkeley. She's writing a book on offshore tax havens and did a piece for the New Statesman. It's headlined The End of Empire and the Rise of Tax Havens. We'll talk about the connection between tax evasion and colonialism in a minute, but I wanted to first go to Ben Hallman. Ben, lay out what you think are your most explosive findings so far.
Right. I mean, I think the big picture finding is that this we've uncovered a system that benefits the few at the expense of the many. You know, you mentioned at the outset, some of the video mentioned some of the big names. King Abdullah of Jordan, through a convoluted shell game, offshore shell game, bought mansions in Malibu. The Prime Minister of the Czech Republic secretly bought a chateau in France. And hundreds of other politicians besides. And I think that is really the big takeaway for us, at least, is that, you know, some of the people who are in a position to potentially stop offshore abuses are, in fact, themselves benefiting from this dark system, dark money system.
But Ben, as your series points out, in many cases, this is not illegal. It's just hidden. Could you talk about the difference there and how often crimes are committed under the cover of the law, not in violation of the law?
Right. Well, I mean, what we see here is jurisdiction shopping, right? Sort of an international game of arbitrage where companies and companies have, you know, built tremendous expertise in helping their clients find places to hide their money in secrecy and legally, quite legally. So, you know, a small jurisdiction, you know, the British Virgin Islands or the Seychelles, you know, these are jurisdictions where it's possible to set up a company for a few hundred or a few thousand dollars and not even disclose the fact that you are the actual owner of the company. You can set them up through frontmen, through what's called nominee shareholders and directors. So, you know, this is in fact, it's a legal system. I will say that some of what we've just charted is also legal money flowing through offshore. And so that's sort of a different story. But broadly speaking, yeah, obviously the use of offshore shelters is legal.
And of course, it didn't necessarily start in those small countries. Delaware has a long history right here in the United States, and now South Dakota is becoming a big haven as well. Could you talk about the local U.S. versions of this?
Yeah, look, one thing we wanted to do is point out a little bit of, I guess, we'll call Western world hypocrisy on this subject. You know, the U.S. and the U.K. and others have been quick to chide smaller countries. You know, you're kind of, when you think of a tax shelter, you think of a palm tree lined island, you know. But look, I mean, the U.S. is one of the biggest jurisdictions, secrecy jurisdictions in the world. We have a story that focuses on South Dakota, which over the last few decades has really come to rival offshore, you know, traditional offshore tax havens as sort of a haven for people to hide their assets. The trust industry, we report, has essentially rewritten the laws of that state to make it possible for people to hold money. And one of the things they advertise is not just secrecy, but sort of longevity and perpetuity, forever, they promise.
So go through some of the names. I was struck by how, I mean, you're talking about, you know, Uhuru Kenyatta in Kenya. You're talking about King Abdullah. But some of the richest men in the world are right here in the United States, and you're not seeing their names.
We have a story about Robert Brockman, one of the richest men in the U.S. who set up tax shelters in Belize. But it's true that generally speaking, U.S. billionaires are not mentioned very much in this data leak, and that can be for a few reasons. For one is, look, this is the most expansive, the biggest offshore leak ever. It has, I think, offers unparalleled view into the economy, but it's not. It doesn't include everything. I mean, the Cayman Islands are a massive tax haven. We do not have any documents of the Cayman Islands. I think the other thing you might be seeing here is just simply that American billionaires have figured out other ways to avoid taxes.
So let's bring Professor Vanessa Ogle into this conversation. You're a professor of history at University of California, Berkeley. You're working on a book on tax havens and the offshore economy. And you wrote a very telling article in the New Statesman headlined "The End of Empire and the Rise of Tax Havens." Give us the historical context here, how you relate colonialism to tax evasion.
Yeah, absolutely. And thank you for having me on. It's an honor and a pleasure. So we see tax havens emerge really for the first time on a sort of significant scale already in the 1920s and 30s. And at this point, it is a direct reaction to the introduction of income taxes in many countries in Europe and also in the United States. But then there's a second phase during which tax havens expand and new tax havens, important tax havens that we know today, appear on the scene, and that is in the 1950s and 60s. So that is when you get places like the Bahamas that really sort of take off as a tax haven. That is when you get the Cayman Islands, eventually the British Virgin Islands, and so on. And so during these decades, there's a direct connection between the end of colonial rule, the end of European empires, and the expansion of these havens at the same time. So what you have is a situation where European settlers, European businessmen who have been doing business, who have been living in the colonial world, for instance, in Kenya, which is a British colony at that point, of course, they have been living there and they have been doing business there, and they begin to see, if you want, the writing on the wall, and they begin to see local anti-colonial independence movements. And they begin to worry about the safety of their assets in these places, because after all, they've been there for decades, sometimes centuries, and they've, in the view of local populations, certainly oppressed and these populations and ruled against their will. So it might be that, you know, new governments might not look so favorably on the presence of these Europeans. So what they do when it becomes clear that, you know, some of these places will become independent is these Europeans begin to move assets out of the colonial world. And because at this time, tax rates in places like Britain, in places like France, are relatively high, right? These are the sort of decades in which European welfare states are financed by high tax rates. Because that is the case, they decide to move assets to other places. And among other places, they choose the Bahamas. French settlers and French businessmen choose Switzerland. And essentially, you get a situation where in a place like the Bahamas, the seed money for the expansion of these tax havens comes out of the colonial world, comes from these settlers and others who are about to essentially leave these places and who are looking for shelters to place their assets because they don't want to pay the high taxes back home in Britain. And that puts in place a whole infrastructure of tax evasion. If you want an ecosystem of lawyers, of bankers, of accountants who facilitate this and who enable this. And so I think it is important when we talk today about, elite corruption in low-income countries, especially those with colonial pasts, it is important to point to the kind of longer histories of this and the legacies of European colonialism.
And Professor Ogle, could you talk specifically about Mauritius and its central role in basically hiding the colonial wealth of portions of Africa?
Absolutely, yes. So Mauritius is a tax haven that has appeared on the scene a little more recently, sort of since the 1990s. And basically, Mauritius has, through a combination of so-called tax treaties and very low tax rates for companies registered in Mauritius, Mauritius has found a way to make itself a sort of stepping stone for investments in sub-Saharan Africa. And it means that Western companies that want to, funnel funds, route funds into sub-Saharan African countries, they basically go through Mauritius in order to avoid paying taxes in these countries in sub-Saharan Africa. And to instead benefit from the extremely low or zero tax rates that Mauritius essentially sort of offers them. And this is particularly harmful for economies in this part of the world because they rely to a greater extent than many rich countries on corporate taxes as a source of revenue, which has to do with the sort of makeup of these economies where you have a big informal sector where it is much harder to collect revenue and collect taxes, which means that corporate taxes, which are generally speaking easier to collect sometimes, are
an important
source of revenue.
Professor Vanessa Ogle, I want to thank you for being with us. University of California, Berkeley history professor writing a book on offshore tax havens. And thank you so much to Ben Hallman, who is senior editor at ICIJ, the International Consortium of Investigative Journalists. We'll link to the articles on the Pandora Papers. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez.
the Bon Appetit Test Kitchen, and you're listening to WRCT Pittsburgh, Carnegie Mellon University's radio station that cooks up tasteful tunes all day and all night. Hey guys, I'm Andy Barangani from the Bon Appetit Test Kitchen, and you're listening to WRCT Pittsburgh, Carnegie Mellon University's radio station that cooks up tasteful tunes all day and all night. Hey guys, I'm Andy Barangani from the Bon Appetit Test Kitchen, and you're listening to WRCT Pittsburgh, Carnegie Mellon University's radio station that cooks up tasteful tunes all day and all. Hey guys, I'm Andy Barangani from the Bon Appetit Test Kitchen, and you're listening to WRCT Pittsburgh, Carnegie Mellon University's radio station that cooks up tasteful tunes all day and all. Hey guys, I'm Andy Barangani from the Bon Appetit Test Kitchen, and you're listening to WRCT Pittsburgh, Carnegie Mellon University's radio station that cooks up tasteful tunes all day and all. Hey guys, I'm Andy Barangani from the Bon Appetit Test Kitchen, and you're listening to WRCT Pittsburgh, Carnegie Mellon University's radio station that cooks up tasteful tunes all day and all. Hey guys, I'm Andy Barangani from the Bon Appetit Test Kitchen, and you're listening to WRCT Pittsburgh, Carnegie Mellon University's radio station that cooks up tasteful tunes all day and all. Hey guys, I'm Andy Barangani from the Bon Appetit Test Kitchen, and you're listening to WRCT Pittsburgh, Carnegie Mellon University's radio station that cooks up tasteful tunes all day and all. Hey guys, I'm Andy Barangani from the Bon Appetit Test Kitchen, and you're listening to WRCT Pittsburgh, Carnegie Mellon University's radio station that cooks up tasteful tunes all day and all. Hey guys, I'm Andy Barangani from the Bon Appetit Test Kitchen, and you're listening to WRCT Pittsburgh, Carnegie Mellon University's radio station that cooks up tasteful tunes all day and all. Hey guys, I'm Andy Barangani from the Bon Appetit Test Kitchen, and you're listening to WRCT Pittsburgh, Carnegie Mellon University's radio station that cooks up tasteful tunes all day and all. Hey guys, I'm Andy Barangani from the Bon Appetit Test Kitchen, and you're listening to WRCT Pittsburgh, Carnegie Mellon University's radio station that cooks up tasteful tunes all day and all. Hey guys, I'm Andy Barangani from the Bon Appetit Test Kitchen, and you're listening to WRCT Pittsburgh, Carnegie Mellon University's radio station that cooks up tasteful tunes all day and all. Hey guys, I'm Andy Barangani from the Bon Appetit Test Kitchen, and you're listening to WRCT Pittsburgh, Carnegie Mellon University's radio station that cooks up tasteful tunes all day and all. Hey guys, I'm Andy Barangani from the Bon Appetit Test Kitchen, and you're listening to WRCT Pittsburgh, Carnegie Mellon University's radio station that cooks up tasteful tunes all day and all. Hey guys, I'm Andy Barangani from the Bon Appetit Test Kitchen, and you're listening to WRCT Pittsburgh, Carnegie Mellon University's radio station that cooks up tasteful tunes all day and all. Hey guys, I'm Andy Barangani from the Bon Appetit Test Kitchen, and you're listening to WRCT Pittsburgh, Carnegie Mellon University's radio station that cooks up tasteful tunes all day and all. Hey guys, I'm Andy Barangani from the Bon Appetit Test Kitchen, and you're listening to WRCT Pittsburgh, Carnegie Mellon University's radio station that cooks up tasteful tunes all day and all. Hey guys, I'm Andy Barangani from the Bon Appetit Test Kitchen, and you're listening to WRCT Pittsburgh, Carnegie Mellon University's radio station that cooks up tasteful tunes all day and all. Hey guys, I'm Andy Barangani from the Bon Appetit Test Kitchen, and you're listening to WRCT Pittsburgh, Carnegie Mellon University's radio station that cooks up tasteful tunes all day and all. Hey guys, I'm Andy Barangani from the Bon Appetit Test Kitchen, and you're listening to WRCT Pittsburgh, Carnegie Mellon University's radio station that cooks up tasteful tunes all day and all. Hey guys, I'm Andy Barangani from the Bon Appetit Test Kitchen, and you're listening to WRCT Pittsburgh, Carnegie Mellon University's radio station that cooks up tasteful tunes all day and all. Hey guys, I'm Andy Barangani from the Bon Appetit Test Kitchen, and you're listening to WRCT Pittsburgh, Carnegie Mellon University's radio station that cooks up tasteful tunes all day and all. Hey guys, I'm Andy Barangani from the Bon Appetit Test Kitchen, and you're listening to WRCT Pittsburgh, Carnegie Mellon University's radio station that cooks up tasteful tunes